Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast with your host, Andrew Keel. This is the podcast where you can get the education you need to invest 100% passively in the highly profitable niche of mobile home parks.
Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast. This is your host, Andrew Keel, and today we have a special guest on the show in Mr. Jeff Flynn of Aspen Ridge Capital. Before we dive in, I want to ask you a real quick favor. If at the end of the show, you get some value out of this, please leave us a review after listening. This helps us get more listeners and supports the show. All right, let's dive in. Jeff Flynn, founder of Aspen Ridge Capital, is a Navy veteran who began his journey in real estate as a mobile home park broker during his final year of service. Just 3 days after leaving the Navy, he transitioned full-time into mobile home park ownership, quickly building a portfolio of 8 mobile home parks. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Andrew. I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, excited to dive in here and get to know you a little better. Maybe you could start out by telling us a little bit more about your story and how in the world you got into investing in mobile home parks.
Right. Well, I always like saying that ever since I was a little kid, I dreamed of one day owning mobile home parks, and everybody always laughs because obviously that's not something you grow up doing. But for me, it was really a lot of luck, right? And luck, it's easier to get lucky when you're working hard. Sure. But looking back, I knew I wanted to get into real estate, especially as my time in service was dwindling down. And I just kind of got lucky that somebody I knew somebody who was running a mobile home park brokerage. So I ended up working there, and it ended up being a really, really good paid education in the industry.
Awesome. Which brokerage firm was that?
At the time when I started, it was Delta Group, and then it became MHP Brokerage. And that's okay. What it is today, MHP Brokerage.
Very cool. Yeah, I know those guys on the email list, looking at deals and things like that. And how long were you in brokerage then, while you were in the service? Was it just a couple of years?
It was just a couple of years. My first real estate transaction was actually as an investor. I was using the VA loan. I bought a condo that I was house hacking. And that was about the time that I kind of got into the idea of like, hey, I need to make some extra money because I can only do a zero down deal one or two times. So that's when I kind of realized I needed to get going on it.
Very cool. And then, so you bought your first park literally 3 days after getting out of the service. Is that right?
That's right. It was touch and go for a while because at the time I was working in a skiff and I couldn't answer my phone. I couldn't even have my phone on me for an 8-hour shift. And, I was just a little E5 enlisted guy in the Navy. I was trying to go out to my car when I could, and I'd see all these voicemails from bankers and vendors and all this stuff I was supposed to be doing. I was like, man, and it would always be after hours by the time I called them back. So it was stressful. But to me, it was just one of those things. Like, I'm not the type to sit around and figure it out. Like, I'm just going to go. And I knew that, being in the military, I had a pretty steady paycheck getting out. I had to do something. And so to me, it was just a matter of let's get it going. So I checked out on Friday, moved from Colorado to Alabama on the weekend. So I was driving into U-Haul Saturday, Sunday, and then Monday was the first closing. So it was one thing right into the next.
That's so cool, Jeff. And what year was that?
That was 2022.
Okay. Awesome. So, you've built up, a nice little portfolio here in just a couple of years. Tell us about that first park. How many lots? What did it look like? What type of market was it in?
It was a 34 lot park, your typical mom and pop deal, right? Like, the guy had never thought about selling it. He had a septic company 40, 50 years ago. So he just built one lot at a time.
Nice.
And it was kind of one of those things. It was a small town in Alabama. It was in Tallahassee, Alabama. But it was an area I was familiar with because I had lived in Auburn, Alabama for a while, and one of my best friends lived in Tallahassee. So I knew that it was a better market than it might seem on the surface. And it was just a place I was familiar with, which allowed me to really connect with the owner. Like, even though I was living, a flight away, I was talking to him about it like I was a local, because I had been at one point. So it was just months and months of following up with the guy. And eventually he just said, hey, here's my number. If you could take it, I'll sell. And he was asking $620,000. And so it was a pretty good deal on the surface. Yeah. And, just like the week prior, I was looking at parks in where I lived in Colorado. And I went to a 7-lot park where the guy was asking $600,000. So you know, it's apples and oranges. But at the time, I was like, okay, this might make sense for me to try to buy this and move down there. So that's how it came to be.
That's so awesome, man. Good for you. And then did you find this just cold calling, just doing what you were doing at the brokerage firm?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was doing. And as a broker, it's kind of difficult to do smaller deals like that, just because you're going to do just as much work as you would do on a multi-million dollar deal. Sure. And it's honestly probably going to be more work because a lot of those sellers are not super organized. So you're going to have to do a lot of digging and hold their hand along the process. So for me, there was one or two that I had known about that I had stumbled upon when I was cold calling, and that was one of them. So it was just a case where I tried to look them up on the GIS, couldn't find it. I saw it on Google Maps. I went on Street View, saw the park's sign on Street View and called it. And sure enough, it was the owner.
So smart. Just getting on Google Maps and driving through the streets, calling the number on the sign, you know, taking that extra effort instead of just skip tracing it and, you know, not getting a good phone number and not getting a hold of the owner. A lot of the best deals are found just with that extra little bit of effort. So kudos to you, man.
Right.
And one thing I want to say, Jeff, you know, thank you for your service. You know, I think all of our veterans, we just had Veterans Day recently, you know, really thankful for your service. And I'm glad that, you know, you're into real estate and you're doing well.
Of course. I appreciate that.
Awesome, man. Yeah. So that was your first park. And then tell us about your portfolio now. You're up to 8 mobile home communities. What does your team look like? Is it just you? You know, I know you're managing them in-house, but maybe you can just tell us about your portfolio.
Yeah. So the first one I had two partners on. And one of them was an experienced operator going into it. So it was really nice for me. Like when the bank was asking us our questions, it was more directed at him, right? Mm. I probably wouldn't have qualified just on my own. And experience-wise, I didn't feel comfortable going into it by myself. So I had two partners on the first 6 deals we did. And then that was around the time that the market started to get much tougher, right? In 2022, you could pretty much throw a rock at a deal and probably find something worth buying. And it just got tough because the rates got higher. And that's when I had officially completely left brokerage. I had unofficially left a little bit sooner than that. And, you know, both of my partners were at the time were kind of just like, hey, deals aren't really penciling out as well right now. So they kind of wanted to pivot and do other stuff. But I had really enjoyed parks. I really enjoyed the operations and finding deals. So that's when I decided to find a way to keep going. I'd never heard the term syndication, but I just figured, hey, there's got to be a way to keep doing deals. Because I know so many guys as a broker that I was talking to that are just doing deal after deal after deal. And it was after a certain amount of time, I realized, okay, this can't be all their money. Somehow they've got investors or something. So I've done 2 deals now as a syndication. So really have enjoyed that process. That's been a ton of fun. And it's been really cool to share the experience with other people, right, who don't want to spend the time and get involved in the nitty-gritty like I do. But that's where it is today. It's 8 parks. It's 250 lots. Most of them are in Alabama. There's 1 park in Mississippi, but I'm relatively uninvolved in that. My partner pretty much does everything on that one because it's close to him. But that's where it is today.
Very cool, man. That's so awesome. Yeah, we syndicate as well. You know, tell us about those 2 syndication deals. You know, how'd you find them? What do they look like? You know, what type of markets are they in? And you said they're all in Alabama and then there's 1 in Mississippi, right?
Right.
How'd you pick that area? Were you moving there just on your own and just decided that's where you want to own? Or how'd you decide on Alabama and Mississippi?
Well, I think it started when I was a broker. We all kind of had regions and I had started calling all over the place, California, New York, Michigan. And I just always gravitated toward the southern states simply for the fact that the owners were really fun to talk to. I would try to find people wanting to sell their parks in California. It was usually I'm not selling, click buy, but Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, I could really get a conversation going. So that really attracted me to just kind of continuing to work that region. I wish I could say it was more economic driven than that, but that's really how it kind of started. And before I had joined the service, I went to Auburn University, which is in Alabama. So I was very familiar with that area. Nice. And when it came time to actually talk to sellers on the phone, that familiarity really, really helped. So that's why Alabama was my primary focus in the beginning. At this point, I'm looking pretty much anywhere in the Southeast, but just haven't come across anything yet outside of that. But hopefully I will soon.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And yeah, those 2 syndication deals, how many lots are they? What did the deal look like, and so forth? Was it value add, stabilized, that kind of thing?
Yeah, both of them were value add. So they were what I would consider your typical mom and pop. They built, both of them had built their own park years ago. Wow. And just were the only owners. And one of them, the first one was actually really nice, huge. I think about a third acre per lot. It was a subdivision that the guys had inherited from his father, who got it plotted out as a subdivision, but never did it. So it looks kind of like a neighborhood, but it was just a case where, you know, 10 years ago, he just figured, hey, I'm not going to really fix much more. I'm getting kind of tired and I'm not going to charge much more in rent. And that's where he left it. And, you know, fast forward, we're going through, you know, just 10 years alone, but the inflation today, it's way below. It was about half of what I thought the market should be charging. And the other parks near there weren't quite as nice as this one. So it was about 2 years of following up with the guy, just once a month, calling him, see how he's doing. And it was, you know, at one point I had it under LOI 2 years ago, and then he just decided, you know, I don't know what I would do if I sold it. And that's kind of where it left. And then eventually it got to a point where he just wanted to travel the country and he wanted to be totally done with it. So got it moving. It was 44 lots, all tenant owned home, which I've learned is the only way I want to go in the future. So it was a pretty quick turnaround, right? We sub-metered it. No infill really to do other than one lot now that we've got to fill up. So wow. That was the first one. Second one was very similar. It was the 32 lots, and just like the first one, I had been following up with the owner for years, really. And then it just by coincidence, one time I had been talking to him on the phone, and looking back, I should have realized something was not quite right. But every time I talked to him, we kind of had the same conversation. He's like, yeah, I don't know if I'm ready to sell it yet. Just send me a letter. So I've got your info. And I probably sent the guy 10, 15 letters. Come to find out that he had been suffering from dementia. His daughter had become the power of attorney, and she just overheard one of the calls, called me outside of that, said, hey, we've been looking to sell this. If you want to buy it, let's get something together. So in both cases, it was just follow up value add deals where the bones of the park were fine. It was just a case where the owners really hadn't kept rents up where they had to be. And as a result, things had started to kind of slip. So I come in as the new owner, fix the obvious stuff, run the properties as professionally as I can, and then just keep moving it from there. Keep a nice, smooth transition for the tenants.
That's awesome. And yeah, what do you, on a deal like that? Because I see those, you know, sometimes where market rents are, you know, way higher, you know, $150, $250 higher. You know, how do you go into those deals? Like, obviously the sub-metering is a piece of the value add, but how comfortable are you, like, raising rents? Like, how much year one and how much year two are you comfortable raising? And then, you know, have you seen any issues, any kickback from the tenants and or anybody that moves out from those rent increases?
I have never had a home move out from a rent increase, with the exception of probably one, but that it was a repossession a few months after the closing. I think what has helped with that is going door to door to all the tenants after closing and explaining to them, like, hey, I used to say owner, now I say manager, so they don't ask me for every single little maintenance request. But that's usually the process. And I found that really, really effective, because on the outside, you might think, hey, these people don't want their rents to go up, which is true. Nobody wants to pay more in rent. But they also want to make sure that the community that their home is more or less stuck in is continuing to be maintained. Mm. And so when you go there and say, hey, look, I know I'm charging you more for rent, I'm trying to keep it affordable, but here's XYZ, this is what we're going to do. We're going to do landscaping, we're going to trim the trees. You've got a maintenance request the owner hasn't dealt with for months at a time. We're going to take care of it. And that has kind of led to a little bit of a sticker shock, usually after a closing. But within the first quarter, I think normally most tenants have realized, okay, this is more, but we're getting more value for it. These guys are actually addressing issues when they come up, when other tenants are causing issues, like loud music or stuff, they're addressing it. And I have found that tenants are really, really excited to have a new owner most of the time.
That's awesome. Yeah. And what do you think that's worth? Like, how much year one are you guys bumping rents, and how much year two are you guys bumping rents?
Usually the first year it's a lot. And then after that, it just kind of tapers off. So I'd say on average, it's probably about $100 a month in the first year. And normally it's just so low to begin with. Like the most recent one I did, they were charging $160 a month. You can't maintain
That's
anything.
So cheap.
It is. And the problem is like, you can't maintain anything and you start seeing the trees overgrow and the roads start to go to hell. And so that's usually what it looks like year one. And then from years two on, it's really just a steady, you know, mm-hmm. $30 to $40 increase. And honestly, like it didn't used to be, but this year it was almost required. Like even doing $100, we're breaking even just because we're trying to make sure that we can cover the note. And on the first year, that's when most of your expenses are going to come up. So it really is just a process of getting it to where it needs to be. And when it's so far behind, you know, I don't want to come in there and double it, but it takes time. You have to be strategic about getting up as quickly as you can to make sure the property improves.
And that's interesting. Yeah. Cause I think, you know, to get it, I guess you're of the mentality like, hey, let's just rip the Band-Aid off. Let's get it up there instead of like, you know, slowly going through that. And it doesn't seem like you've had much turnover. I've had some other experiences where like literally 5 tenants moved out after we increased rents. And we didn't even go that much. We went $60 in the first year and we had like 5 tenants move out. So I think it's market specific. It's demand specific. Like, hey, is there other parks in the area that they can move their homes to? You know, is it an affluent population where they can buy private land and move their homes out to private land? And, you know, I think it depends on so many different factors, but that's good that your properties have been performing well. You know, Jeff, I know you guys run it's all vertical, right? Like you guys do the property management in-house. Tell me about your team. Tell me about your operation and what that looks like.
In the beginning, I kind of had the idea that my properties are what I would consider small to medium. Right. Mm. The biggest is 62 lots. The smallest is 15. I wouldn't do another 15 lot deal. It has just not been feasible really in retrospect. But the management in the beginning was one on-site manager at each park who kind of reported to us and did XYZ. And then all the back end stuff like the property management software, leases, we did all that. That I ended up scrapping just because it tended to invite more management drama than it actually produced. It was, and looking back at the conclusion I came to is like, if I'm buying a park because I don't think it's managed well, I should not keep the managers that were there when I bought it. Even if they're great at this point, the last one I bought, they did have somebody who helped on site, but I've just found that it's better to just do it our way. Come in, we manage it. And then a year later, if we want to have somebody on site to assist, then we revisit that. But I think just setting the tone that things are different, we run things this way, this is how it goes, that has been a lot better. And at this point, the team is really just me and a full-time virtual assistant. We have an on-site maintenance guy who, for all the ones in Alabama, they're all in about an hour and a half radius.
Oh, nice.
So he'll go around with a 360 camera and he'll report back to us just by taking, you know, a bunch of shots of the property. We can look at it and see the property as if we're there, make notes of skirting that needs to get fixed, all that kind of stuff, all the on-site stuff that you have to be on site to do. There's no other way to do it.
Sure.
But then all the back end stuff at this point is really just done virtually.
Nice. Very nice. Yeah. I think virtual assistants are great. We have several on our team and it just helps you be more places, you know, at the same time, but it's tough. I think we reached about 5 parks where it was like myself and an assistant. And then it was like, we reached our capacity and we needed to hire people and, you know, build the property management company out just because there's a lot of touch points, you know, but that's awesome. So you're at about 250 lots. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Very nice. That's awesome. Given that, what do you think is the toughest hurdle, you know, so far in mobile home park investing that you've ran into?
Part of it, I would say, is that one of the pros is that you can scale quickly, but the downside to that is for a relatively low dollar amount, you have a lot of scale, which I think can actually be a negative in some situations. Like we have 250 tenants to deal with, right? And that's that scale. It's happening quickly, but it's still 250 people that we got to keep track of. So that has been very, very difficult. That's one of the biggest challenges. Secondly, I would just say is consistency. It's been, you know, as an entrepreneur, we wear a lot of hats and there's months that I have the time to sit down and do what I need to do. And then there's months where I forgot about it. And so for me, I think just setting up the systems and processes and having somebody else responsible for absolutely every single thing that needs to happen. That has been the biggest challenge. And I'm finding ways to kind of go about that. I think AI has actually been really helpful in helping me do that. But I would say, number one, it would be, you know, ongoing management operations of just, it just doesn't stop. Every month you got to do collections and you got to stay on top of it. If you don't, people get too far behind to catch up and then you're really in trouble. So that's definitely one of the struggles.
I'm smiling a little bit because I totally see where you're at. And I remember, you know, like I said, being around five parks and trying to, you know, use the management fees coming in to like hire people, but realizing like, hey, this isn't going to go very far, and realizing all the things that needed to be done. And it gets easier, you know, as you keep scaling, yeah. You're able to get help, right. And then you can have specialization, you know, where, you know, people get really good at doing, you know, certain things. It gets easier, but you're at one of those crucial levels that's really tough, where 250 lots to 500 lots is a big jump, and right. It involves adding, you know, team members, but it's a fun ride, man. And you're in the right asset class, I'll tell you that much.
That's right. It's chicken and the egg scenarios. That's what I always tell my wife. It's like, there's something I need, but I don't have what I need to do it yet, but I still got to do it. But that's being an entrepreneur. You just got to figure it out.
You got to figure it out. Yeah. Some days you'll be opening the mail. Some days you'll be taking out the trash. Some days you'll be changing the ball valve underneath of a home.
That's right.
I've done all of it. So tell me about how you've integrated AI. You said that that's kind of helped you with the management structure and things like that. And I'm always curious because I love artificial intelligence. I love kind of learning new things. So curious how you're implementing that in mobile home parks.
I'm trying to implement it anywhere I possibly can. But I think the biggest thing is basically just helping me teach somebody else nuances without it taking months. Mm. And so what I mean by that is, like, we have an AI that I have sat down and taught every single little difference about each property, right? If one property is city sewer, but the city line stops at the road and we're responsible for it all the way back versus another park where the city maintains it throughout, those little nuances, you hire somebody. I've gone out and fixed problems that we shouldn't have fixed, like city sewer lines that we paid thousands of dollars to repair. It's hard, but it's hard to teach somebody who's not you to do all that. So what I've done at this point is basically our standard operating procedures and the specifics on each property and the goals for each property are all in a central AI. So our assistant, when she has a question, that's the first place she goes to ask it, right? And if she asks it and it says, okay, in this property, you need to do X, Y, Z, blah, blah, blah. Here's who you call. You know, this is the process. That has been life-changing for me.
That's huge. Yeah.
Because even with somebody whose full-time job is, you know, to work for you, a lot of times they're going to have to call and ask you questions on everything because everything's so different. Mm. And that's just one small example. Of course, like, we have some homes where they were park-owned homes. We convert them to rent-to-owns and we'll get maintenance requests and we'll go out and do them. And it's like, no, that's the tenants know maintenance on a rent-to-own is their responsibility. And it's hard to teach all that. Sure. And so that has been something that I have really leaned into to really just help ensure that we get consistent results to people. When tenants ask a question about something, it references their lease and our answer is consistent with their lease to make sure that we're doing exactly what we agreed to. So that has been really, really helpful just in terms of like consistency across the board.
Very cool. So is it similar to like a ChatGPT? You have your own like AI bot that you're training these things, you know, to be aware of? Like, I think that's really awesome because we have all of our SOPs are written down, right? So they're written down and we use Google Sheets and we use Trello and we store them there. But what we're finding now is we have so many SOPs that people are not reading them. And it's like, it's searchable, right? If you go and you search and you look in and you can find how to do X, Y, Z and understand that the sewer system, you know, and understand, you know, where the cleanouts are and things like that. But it'd be easier for the end user if they just had to type in, hey, you know, we have a sewer clog between lots 10 and 13, you know, where's the nearest clean out? And it just shot it back to them, you know, it would be way easier. So I'm curious how you do that and what platform you use to kind of set this up.
It's ChatGPT. It's the paid version. Nice. And you can make your own custom version. So ours doesn't reference the internet. It just references our PDF, which is
what you've uploaded to it. Wow. Mm-hmm.
So its instructions are basically, hey, only give an answer directly referencing the standard operating procedures. if you cannot figure out an answer from the SOPs, it'll just say, ask Jeff for clarification. And so at that point, we'll go in and we'll make, like, over time, those situations just, they don't stop. There's always random situations that come up. But it's relatively easy, right? The GBT that's custom just references the PDF. Every week or so, we update it. And so it has the new version that it references. And our SOPs at this point are actually, they're not just, hey, this is what we need to do. But in a given task, Jeff is responsible for this. The VA is responsible for that. And so when they ask the question, it knows who's asking and it tells them what aspect they need to do. So there's no confusion. There's no like, oh, I thought you did that part, or, oh,
that's great. Yeah. Who the owner is. There's one owner that, you know, you're going to differentiate between. So you really, you got three people on the team. You got Jeff, you got the virtual assistant, and then you got your AI bot. So
yeah.
Kudos, man. That's fantastic. I wanted to go back a second. Like, how'd you get educated on mobile home parks? Like, to know the utility infrastructure, to complete due diligence, like, take us back to that point. And was it podcasts? Was it books? Was it, you know, YouTube? You know, how did you dive in and get educated?
Well, for me, I was very lucky in the fact that the brokerage I worked specialized in it. Mm. And so my education was really just conversations with other investors all day long, right? As a broker, you really have to be good at finding the deal, and you can get started quickly just knowing how to communicate with sellers. But when you start sending deals to buyers and they start kicking it back because X, Y, Z, over time, I just kind of learned through osmosis, like, hey, this is what you should look for. This is how this should go. But that stops the day of closing. And I learned that very quickly. I didn't know anything about what happens after the day of closing. And it was like a panic attack for me. So in the beginning, it was podcasts like Frank Rolfs. I listened to his a ton and just listened to episode after episode after episode. And that was super helpful. But even that, it was more geared towards like really nice part. Not all, but like he's been doing it for a while. So they were back in the day when, not to make light of it, because they've definitely accomplished a lot, but parks were selling at like 10 caps. You could just buy 100 lots, city water, city sewer pretty easily, right? I'm not dealing with that.
One of the things he says that I always, you know, give him crap about is he always says, oh, you can just rehab a vacant park-owned home for $4,000. And get it back rent ready. And I'm like, oh, not anymore, Frank. Not anymore.
Yeah. And it's a lot of it was just learning through, just sitting down and figuring out what am I doing that's working? What am I doing that's not? And it's unfortunately, a lot of it's just learning on the job. And I was lucky that the first couple of deals, investors weren't involved. It was just me and my partners. So when we made mistakes, we just owned it and moved on. We didn't really have to answer to it. But that was when I finally felt comfortable, like, okay, I've done enough of these that within reason, I know what's probably going to happen. And I know the best way to handle a situation, like you said, like a vacant park-owned home. And so, most of it, I would say, is kind of three phases, learning just from the broker side on how to find them, close them, what to look for. Then it was podcast to kind of learn the operation side. And then you got to take other people's opinions with a grain of salt, even if they're the best in the industry, because your niche, like my niche within mobile home parks, is the small to medium size. I don't always have on-site managers. I don't have all the things that you normally could to make it work. So you have to just figure it out.
Totally. Yeah. There's a lot of different niches. And one of the things I have, it's a sticky note right here. It's a Sam Zell, quote, where he's like, hey, what does the deal hinge on? What's the biggest risk? You know, and just trying to identify that first before anything else can just save you so much time. And you know, knowing, hey, the utility infrastructure is probably one of the biggest things you need to get comfortable with before you do any phase one, any survey, anything else. Figure out the utility infrastructure and obviously the rent roll. But that's really awesome, man. Kudos to you. I wanted to go in now and talk a little bit about like higher interest rates and how you guys have pivoted around that to get deals done, you know, in the last few years.
Honestly, a lot of it has just, in some ways, it's opened up the avenue for more creativity, more seller financing, more whatnot. But it has definitely made me more rigid on buying criteria, right? Because with interest rates, everybody kind of had the opinion when they went up, they'd come right back down. Well, now in hindsight, we can see that's not going to happen. And so to me, I don't try to make deals work. They have to just work on the surface level. Or if they don't, maybe a tiny bit of stretching here or there. But the toughest part has just been, I think, the lending requirements, right? Mm. they've tightened down. That's been the toughest thing of all. Like, there's still sellers who want to sell, probably more so than there were 2 years ago, but now they realize they missed the boat. But even a deal that was great 2 years ago, it's going to be hard to close today because the rate for offering makes the NOI, you know, it has to really perform. Honestly, I take the opinion, like, if I can get a deal done today and it cash flows year one, that's a property I want to own for a very long time, right? 2 years ago, you could, when you're getting 5% and 4% interest rates, most deals work, right? And nowadays, if a deal does pencil, it's probably a really, really solid asset.
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah. If it works with a 7.5% interest rate, you know, it's going to really work a few years from now after, you know, right, some value add and some rent increases. So yeah, I agree with you there. Tell me about your strategy, Jeff, and like, how did it originate? You know, it seems like your strategy would be to target, you know, smaller to mid-size parks, value add, going direct to mom and pop owners, which I think is a really good niche right now. I think even like our criteria is 50 lots or more. And with that, we've seen that cohort even get more competitive, right? Because I think some of the bigger private equity firms that used to only buy stuff 50 lot or only used to only buy stuff 100 lots or more are now coming down and getting comfortable with 50 lots or more. So I think below 50 lots, you can really get some good deals. I mean, at the end of 2023, we bought two parks that were like around 30 to 35 lots at 12 caps on actuals. So like, those opportunities are out there. And you know, if you were looking at a 50 lot park, there's no way, you know, that you could get a 12 cap right on actuals. Like, it's unheard of. So maybe you can talk about your strategy and is it just focusing on those smaller parks and getting, you know, off market deals, or what, you know, what high level are you looking to do?
Well, to answer the part about how I kind of stumbled into that strategy, it really just became, you know, when I was cold calling, there's not a lot of parks out there. And you realize that very quickly as a broker. Like, I mean, you make 100 calls a day, I'd go through the entire state of Alabama in 10 days. There's about 1,000 parks there. And if that's your full-time job, right, it's kind of tough. But I pretty much called everything. You know, if it was 15 lots and up, I didn't really, at the time, I didn't really understand that, hey, if I close a 10-lot park and get a 4% fee, that's not going to keep the lights on. Sure. So I knew of a lot of deals available like this. And to me as a buyer, they make a ton of sense, right? I'm like, okay, I'm looking at what this can do. Cash flow wise, it makes a ton of sense. There is a downside, right? Those, they're harder to manage. You don't have as big of a buyer pool on the back end. If you can get your hands on a 50 lot park or above, pretty confident you'll be able to turn around and sell that for a good price. Some of the market fundamentals like cap rates and stuff, they start to break down when you go underneath those parks. Like, sure, that park might appraise for a 7 cap, but can you really get a buyer pay a cap rate, a 7 cap for something like that? But to me, it was really just a matter of everybody I talked to at the time, 100 lots or more, major city, you know, 100,000 plus population, which I get, that makes sense. But some of these other parks, they're just so cheap, they do still make sense, right? And like, another big thing that I was looking at was, at the time, the kind of notion I was hearing from other investors looking were like, they would look at the cost of a single family house in that area. And where I'm at in Alabama, it's not that expensive. And so a lot of people would pass on it just for that. But when I lived there, I kind of came to this realization that houses might not be that expensive, but nobody is building houses at all. If you go anywhere, everybody lives in mobile homes, whether it's a private lot or a park. And so the demand for these parks is still pretty strong. So that was kind of what kind of led me towards that path. And obviously, I'd love to get my hands on a big park in a nice city. You're just going to be paying a different price, right? And for me, it's just a much better, at this stage of my career, it's a much better return on my time to do a smaller deal that I won't have a lot of buying competition. I don't have that many tenants to deal with, and I can turn it around pretty quick.
Yeah, no, that's a good strategy. Yeah, because you're very hands-on with it. Because you can be, right? You go door to door to all 44 tenants and meet them, talk to them about the rent increase and what they're going to get for it. So that's awesome. That's the level of, you know, personal touch that with scale becomes unachievable and it gets a little bit tougher. So that's good. What mistakes, Jeff, have you made in your mobile home park investing that we could learn from?
I'd say one, there's a couple parks where I guess I'd have to explain a little bit more about my strategy. With these smaller parks, I wouldn't go buy one out just in the middle of nowhere by itself. But if there's a couple in an area, that was what part of my strategy was. Two or three small parks in a big area, in the same area, works. But on the same token, sometimes I put too much value on a park just being close to another one I have. And in retrospect, it's not that much different to manage. And so there's a few parks I would, or there's really one in particular I think I overpaid for. And it was mostly park-owned homes. And it was just kind of one of the situations. Yeah, it cash flowed a lot. I knew it wasn't worth much more than what I was paying for it and wouldn't be worth much more than I was paying for it. But it was local and it was part of my portfolio. So I figured it makes sense. In retrospect, it's that doesn't really do that much, right? Maybe when I go to sell, I'll change my opinion on that. But that was one mistake. The other mistake was just I knew never to value park-owned homes, but I underestimated how much work they are. Like dealing with 10 park-owned homes, in my eyes, is the same amount of work as a 50-lot park. A closing on a 50-lot park that's alternate on homes. Like, yeah. And it doesn't stop. Like, you have to keep working on it. Whereas those tenant-owned home parks, if you've got the right systems in place, you can turn it around and then more or less be hands-off. So I'm still dealing with park-owned homes from some of the first parks I've bought, even the ones I've converted to rent-to-owns. That doesn't just wipe your hands from it, right? People still leave those homes and you've got to do something to them so somebody else wants them. So that has been a part of it that has really just bogged down my personal time. And looking back, it's like, man, I would have been so much better off passing on those deals and just going and trying to find more that fit exactly what I was trying to do.
That's huge. Yeah. Even like 6 months ago, we were looking at our portfolio and looking at our tenant turnover rate, and, you know, our parks that have more park-owned homes had higher turnover rates, you know, because even though you sell something on a rent-to-own agreement or a rent credit agreement, you know, people will, there's other comparable housing options. You know, when someone's paying $650 a month, $750 a month, you know, lot rent plus their home payment. So right. I think that tracking tenant turnover is really important. And what we realized is like, we're going out selling these homes on like a rent credit program and, you know, trying to maximize, you know, purchase price, maximize, you know, what we can get in terms of like monthly revenue. But we've kind of switched our mindset on that recently, where it's like, hey, let's make it more attractive to the tenant and to like really get them to be a tenant-owned home faster. Because what we ended up doing is we had all these RTO agreements and then we would go refi. We try to refi as quickly as we can. Our model is like buy with a local credit union and then try to refi into agency financing. So we'd go to refi and the bank would say, hey, your proceeds are going to be capped because of the number of park-owned homes you have. So, you know, if you could go and give the titles away to these like 10 or 15 homes, you know, your proceeds could be higher and your loan amount could be higher. So we were like, well, instead of having to do this on the back end, why don't we do this on the front end, you know, with when we're selling the home, like say, hey, you know, this is a $12,000 home, you know, instead of selling it with $1,500 down, hey, can you do $6,000 cash? You know, like call your grandma, call your aunt and uncle, call your mom and dad, call everybody you know, because you and I both know that this home's worth $12,000 and I'm going to sell it to you for $6,000 cash. And lo and behold, sometimes they come up with the $6,000 cash and it's an instant tenant-owned home, which, you know, is much more preferred instead of waiting on the back end and then just having to like give out the title. So we're doing some stuff like that. And then also with some of our park-owned homes that are like straight rentals, they were paying like $800 to $900 a month in straight rentals. We said, hey, we'll just give you the title and then you just have to pay $550 lot rent. You know, where market lot rent maybe is like $350, $400. We can lock them in at that higher lot rent amount and then they'll just own the home. And it's been more of a win-win, but we're still trying to figure it out. There's a lot of ways to skin it, but I agree with you. Park-owned homes can be trouble, you know? So I think just investors listening, you know, park-owned homes, the cash flow will look great, right? It'll look like you're buying a 14 cap if you're counting and capitalizing all of the park-owned home rental income. But, you know, banks don't treat them that way. Banks only will treat park-owned homes. They'll only value them based on what the lot rent portion of their monthly payment would be. So it's something to know and to just kind of add into your tool belt, right, Jeff?
Yeah. The people I've seen that make the park-owned home parks work are the guys who are, they've got handyman experience. They live 10 minutes from the park.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because for them, it does, like the guy we bought it from, he's cash flowing like crazy. He goes over there once or twice a month, or once or twice, probably a week, and fixes something small. Well, for me, sending a guy out there is $200.
Yeah.
And if that happens, it just doesn't work. And I think what I've also found, yes, you can spend $15,000. For me, the number is about $15,000. If I want to go totally rehab a home that is like a true rehab, it's $15,000 on the low end. I can rent it for $750. But I could also just give away the home and rent it for $400. So it's not, am I spending $15,000 to make $750, or can I just spend nothing and get $400? It works much, much, much better. And there's not all the constant dealing with rehabbing used homes and all that kind of stuff. And the problem with the used homes, on if you don't have experience with the mobile home world, you think if we sell this home for you, people, you know, some of the people I talked to are like, why don't you just sell the home for $20,000? Someone will buy it. And that's what I thought. I thought we put $15,000 into this, we'll make $5,000. People really can't buy them, right? Mm-hmm. They're used. There's not really a good loan program for them. So you're stuck doing a rent to own, and it takes you so long. I learned that too slowly. And the same week, my realization was Home Depot called me to congratulate me on being the number three spender in the town. I said, golly, I've got to stop. This is not what I'm supposed to be doing. But yeah, I found the best way is to just give the tenants a great deal, because it turns around and makes your life easier.
Yeah.
And on top of that, you get a tenant who cares.
Totally.
That's so much less maintenance and management on the back end for a tenant who goes through, and we give away homes now, and they'll go through and do all the rehab work themselves. And what we get are just people in the community who care. They take pride of ownership, and they don't want to leave. And that's what we're looking for. So
yeah,
it is huge.
And they're sticky, right? They're sticky. They stay a long time. So that's what you
want. Right.
Jeff, we're running out of time. Got a few more questions for you. Like, if you were going to passively invest, you were going to be an LP in a mobile home park syndication, what are the top things you would look out for and why?
I would look out for what is the exit strategy, right? I'm a huge fan of the buy it, refinance, and hold strategy. And the reason I think that's so great is because you can do this cost segregation study and really save a boatload on your taxes. Mm-hmm. But I see that get pushed by a lot of guys who are planning on selling the property. And you got to look out for that, because you're going to have to pay more in taxes somewhere down the line, right? Hopefully they can 1031, but that's something I would look out for. Are you getting a tax benefit, and does it stay a tax benefit, or are you just pushing it down the road 5 years and you're going to have a really hefty tax bill then? So that's one thing I would look out for. Secondly, I would just look at operations, right? A lot of park owners get so big that they stop really maintaining their parks the way they should be. And it doesn't take much, but it does take consistent work on the deals people have done in the past to make sure that they stay good. And it's really, I'm guilty of it too, where it's really exciting. You close the deal, the first 90 days is great. And then after that, you're like, who's calling? What tenant is that? What park? Like, I don't want to answer that. So that's another thing I'd look out for. It's just, I don't know exactly how you'd check for that, but maybe talk to investors.
Drive through and see how they're doing. Literally pay someone on $50 on Craigslist to go drive through some of our parks before they invested with us. I thought it was the smartest thing any of our investors have done to vet me, right? Say, hey, how does your current parks look, right? If I'm going to invest in with you in a new deal, let me see what they look like. And they did invest with us, but I think that's just an easy step people could take if they have the time. But Jeff, what do you think the perfect mobile home park looks like in your eyes, and why?
I'd say the perfect mobile home park is just the one that's got good bones, but the owners just stopped charging rent years ago, or stopped charging the rent they needed to, where you can charge less than what the market is, but it's still drastically more than what it was when you bought it. So you can increase value, still give a huge value proposition to your tenants, and allow you to refinance, pull your cash out of the deal, but still own it, right? I'm a big believer on holding parks for the long term, because they're really not building more of them. And so for me, I look at a park like, this is going to be a 20-year hold. You know, I want to make sure that it's a park I want to keep for a long time.
That's good. So there's no minimum lots. There's no perfect utility infrastructure you'd look for. It's just, can I refi and pull the capital out? I love that. I mean, that's the end in mind.
Right? Yeah. I might be different than most in this. I prefer septic over city sewer.
Hold on here.
I've just found that like I can operate so much quicker. I do a lot of used home infill.
Yeah.
And to me, I like being in a, I love parks that are outside the city limits, but they're really close to the city. Mm-hmm. Those have been my best performers. So to me, 25 to 50 lots right outside city limits where I run it the way I need to run it. And it just gets
how many leach fields have you replaced thus far?
To date, I think three field lines we've gone through and completely replaced.
Okay. Yeah. So you know that process because it's not cheap to replace
it's those not
things.
Cheap. It's not cheap.
And then I think what the issue is, at least for me, is that the tenants will like flush t-shirts down the toilet and then it clogs up the tank. And then you have to get them pumped and stuff. It's just, you know, it's more maintenance. But if you have like a guy that knows what they're doing, you know, that's able to like, you know, fix those type of issues and get the distribution box on there to like make sure that it doesn't clog up your leach field, you know, it could be good. And obviously like P-traps under the home is a big piece to make sure right. that stuff doesn't get into the septic tanks. But I think you're the first person that said they prefer septic tanks over, you know, some of the other sewer options.
You got to keep in mind, too, that for me, say that I'm not in these major metros where people are just moving in their own brand new mobile homes in droves. If I'm filling up used lots, I'm having to get creative, get used homes in there and sell them. That's the part that's like next to impossible in a city. Like they're skeptical on mobile homes in general. Typically, they don't want a used home coming in, even if we're going to go through and fix it up. Mm-hmm. So that's the part of like if I'm looking at a. Sure. If it's a completely stabilized, completely full park, city sewer is easy. And I've got parks in both. And that part is definitely nicer that I don't have to worry about maintaining it. Mm. But I'm always looking at value add deals. And typically there's there's an infill component, which I've just found quicker and easier in counties. Rather
and
than
what's
cities.
Your secret when it comes to infill? What's your secret? Just real quick. Like how many lots have you infilled? And what do you think are some of the, you know, the tips for those that are looking to do an infill project? Because it's a lot of work.
It is a lot of work. I have found that used homes, at least in the markets I'm in, I can get those sold. I've never done the cash program. I've started the process and I'm eager to try that out. But for me, it's mostly been used homes that I can get from mobile home dealers or mobile home movers. They're constantly sending me like probably once a week, they send me a home. It's like, hey, you want this house? And they're literally free a lot of the times. Mm-hmm. And what I have found is I'm paying out of pocket to move it in. So I'm looking about $3,500 to get it set. But then I'm going to market it for $500 and I'm going to wait and I'm going to screen my tenants thoroughly, check their resources, look for somebody with some construction experience. And then we find somebody who's going to go through and do the project themselves. And we don't give them the title until they've done a checklist on the outside, like new decks, new skirting, new paint, new cool seal, all that kind of stuff. And once they do that, the inside's their problem, but it makes the park look phenomenal. So that's something I have found.
That's a little tip. Yeah, that's a little niche, but you know, because what's your average cost all in to get a home brought in that way?
$3,500,
right? And they're
to move it.
Yeah, to move it. And then to set it, do they block level tie it down?
Yeah. Yeah. For about for a single wide, about $3,500.
Okay. To transport and block level tie down. Okay. Yeah.
Because what it is, it'll be like these mobile home dealers, people are doing trade-ins. And basically the mobile home dealers will give these people cash for their houses. So they could, I don't know if they want me saying that, but they turn around and use that as the down payment on their new house. And they'll basically call me and say, hey, can you just move this? Because what will happen is if I don't buy it, they're going to have to pay $2,000-$3,000 to move it to their site. And then someone's going to have, so then it's just, it adds $2,000-$3,000 to the process. If we get it direct from where it was to our park, and obviously we have to check them. We have to check them to make sure the homes are worth rehabbing because a lot of them are not. A lot of them, we pass on probably 10 for every one that we do. Mm. But when we do it, I'll sit on a home for 6 months before it goes to a person. Just because I know, like, if it goes to that right person, it'll be good and I'll get it filled. And On the low end, I think that adds $35,000 to the value of the park.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is like the value of an occupied lot at, you know, 300, 350 lot rent is probably 35, 40 grand. So, right. You know, and you spent $3,500 to make it happen. So I think you're going to go on, you're going to go down in history as like the cheapest infill. You know, you found a niche there for sure. That's a hack.
Yeah. So. Yeah. For a brief period of time, I actually had a side company, a friend of mine, where we were running a company that specifically did all the exterior stuff for brand new mobile homes getting delivered. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of these institutional parks. They'd bring in 5-10 brand new houses. We'd go skirt them, put decks on, connect the utilities, all that kind of stuff. And it was like $8,000 to $10,000 a house for a new home, you know? And I think what those park owners were doing, they had a fund, but they were paying for it. So not the tenants.
Well, that's what we do. Yeah, we bring in brand new ones and we get it all set up, and then we'll try to sell it with like a chattel loan on site to someone that will actually, you know, get a loan, and then they'll pay lot rent plus their loan payment on the home.
Right.
And, you know, we'll just try to get what we have into it out of it. And obviously it's market specific. Some markets are better than others. And there's a lot of different ways to skin the cat in the mobile home park game. So
that's right.
What do you think is the biggest threat, Jeff, to your mobile home park investing model?
I would think I've thought about this a lot. And one of the things that made me really sit down and think about this was I'm currently in the master's program at University of Denver, and we had the opportunity to go tour a vacant office building in downtown Denver. And I sat there and thought, who would have thought that this building would just sit here empty? And it's economic factors outside of your control. Nothing on a pro forma of those guys who bought that would have showed up. That's the part that keeps me up at night. And I think mobile home parks have a lot of things going for them. Like, somebody has to live somewhere. But I think the biggest threat to my portfolio would be something along the lines of a new government program that gave super, super great financing terms to people who typically wouldn't qualify for zero down houses, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. That to me is something that's just outside of anything anybody can prepare for. So I don't know how realistic it is. Personally, I really don't think it is realistic, but I think that's something. And then outside of that, I have everything in one state for the most part. So it's a great state, but is it a great state 20 years from now? It's hard to tell, right? People in San Francisco probably 20 years ago thought it would just always be great. And it has a lot of problems. So I think, to me, we do a quarterly assessment of the market to just look for anything that's like, hey, is anything in this town or this city going wrong? And we're in a lot of small towns, so we have to be particularly careful of that. But I would say most of the really big factors that could really throw a wrench in my portfolio would be external, like economic factors, mm-hmm. things of that nature.
Yeah, that's a good assessment. Jeff, well, thank you so much for coming on today, man. How can our listeners get a hold of you if they'd like to do so?
I'm pretty active on LinkedIn, so you can look me up. Jeff Flynn, JeffFlynn. A lot of people look for Jeff Lynn. There's an F in front of it, just so you know. There's three Fs in a row. And then my website, aspenridge.capital. It's currently down because we're making some improvements, but depending on when people listen to this, it should be up and running. So reach out to me either of those ways, and I'd love to chat.
Awesome, Jeff. Well, thanks again for coming on the show.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
That's it for today, folks. Reminder, if you got value out of this episode, please leave us a review. Thank you all so much for tuning in.
Would you like to see mobile home park value add projects in progress? If so, follow us on Instagram at @passivemhpinvesting for photos and awesome videos from our recent mobile home park acquisitions. Once again, that's @passivemhpinvesting on Instagram. See you there.